Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
For the millions of fans of Me Before You, The Wait is Nearly Over. The film, based on Jojo Moyes' best-selling book, comes out this week. Arm yourself with tissues. Me Before You tells the story of Louisa Clark, a working-class young Brit in a small town whose waitress gig abruptly ends and her family depends on her for income. She lands a job as caretaker for Will Traynor, a member of the 1% whose high-flying life has been shattered by an accident that leaves him a quadriplegic. She tries to help him. He bitterly resists. It reaches a boiling point.
I'm just trying to do my job as best I can. So it would be really nice if you didn't try and make my life as miserable as you apparently make everyone else's.
And what if I said I didn't want you here?
I'm not employed by you. I'm employed by your mother. So unless she says she doesn't want me here anymore, I'm staying. Not because I care about you or particularly enjoy your company, but because I need the money. I really need the money.
Emilia Clarke of Game of Thrones fame as Louisa, Sam Claflin from The Hunger Games as Will, and you may think you know the template. They fall in love. He falls in and out of pneumonia-induced comas. It appears we're heading towards a love story-like ending. He dies from his disability. She's ennobled by their love, but then something really interesting happens. It becomes a story about assisted dying and choice in end of life. Jojo Moyes adapted the book to the screen. She joins us now. Jojo, many tissues.
That's my favorite thing to hear. I really love making people cry.
Why? Why?
Because if you're that invested in the story, you know, if you've watched that film enough and felt enough to cry, then that means you've really engaged. And that's pretty much the greatest compliment a writer can receive.
Well, a lot of tears shed over the book, a huge bestseller, first in your native Great Britain, then here in the States. Were you surprised by the depth of response to it?
I am surprised daily by the depth of the response. I mean, when I first finished this book, I moved publishers. My career was not going great in publishing terms. And my new publisher said, look, we like this book. We think you'll be able to sell a few copies and we'll kind of start the resurrection of your career with it. And then it went on to sell, I think so far, something like 6 million copies.
Yeah.
It seems to be one of those books that if somebody reads it, they want to tell their friends about it. And in fact, the response to the movie seems to be the same. People are coming out and saying they want to take somebody else to it.
Well, lots of questions because, as we said, it raises some controversial, you step right in a very controversial debate mm-hmm. at the end of it. But talk a little bit about your inspiration, which was real life.
Yeah, well, I'm an ex-journalist and my favorite thing is listening to and reading the news. And I was driving home one day and I heard a story about a young athlete who had been left quadriplegic after an accident and who had persuaded his parents several years later to take him to a center for assisted suicide. And I found this story desperately shocking. Mm. And I couldn't understand how any parent would agree to that. And then I started reading around it and I read about the young man and I read about his parents and I realized that things were not as black and white as I wanted them to be. Mm. You know, as human beings, we like certainty. We like to know what is right and what is wrong. And sometimes in life, you know, there's a lot of gray areas. And more importantly, you can't judge people for the decisions that they make unless you are standing firmly in their shoes.
Well, you've got Will, who's the one who has decided he wants assisted dying. Mm-hmm. He had been a windsurfer, a skier. What could he not do? Also a bit of a jerk. He was, mm-hmm. you know, a corporate raider, it sounds like. And then you've got Louisa, played by Emilia Clarke, who, for our American listeners, her character on screen, it's a little bit like Americo Ferrara, Ugly Betty. She's of the wildly yeah. clashing outfits and, you know, not...
Yeah,
yeah.
That's a good simile, actually. Yeah, yeah. She's like a British Americo Ferrara.
Yeah. yeah.
But she's certainly not an Ugly Betty. She's absolutely beautiful, Amelia.
Well, so was Ugly Betty, as it turns
yeah,
out.
Yeah, that's
but
true.
Here in this scene, she has learned of his decision and she's trying to pull him back to life. And here she suggests a trip to Paris.
Mm-hmm.
So let's go. We could get on the Eurostar right now.
Nah.
But you just said...
You don't get it, Clark. I want to be in Paris as me. The old me. With pretty French girls giving me the eye.
Could be something to look forward to.
If I shut my eyes now, I know exactly how it feels to be in that little square. I remember every sensation. I don't want those memories erased by the struggle to fit behind a table. The taxi drivers who refused to take me, and my wheelchair power pack that won't charge in a French socket.
He does not want to go. In fact, he hates his life so much that he has tried to end it. So a question there about the storyline.
Mm-hmm.
Do you worry that you're sending out the signal that to have a life of a quadriplegic is not one worth living?
That is absolutely not the message I want this story to have. For me, it's more about two human beings and what do you do if the person you love most makes a decision that you cannot even begin to comprehend. And in the book and in the film, we're very clear to show that there are many people who do not agree with what he wants to do on any grounds. And, you know, it's not, nobody thinks that he's right. It's just that this is a very alpha male who just refuses to lead a life that isn't on the terms that he wants. We all think that if perhaps we suffered a similar accident, we'd like to be like Christopher Reeve, you know, somebody who is full of grace and finds a way through. But sometimes you're going to get someone who just refuses to accommodate that new thing.
And do I understand you've actually heard from the Christopher Reeve Foundation?
I have. In fact, one of the things that I was most happy about was after the book came out, the Christopher Reeve Foundation contacted me via my publishers to say they were really pleased that I showed some of the realities of life for a quadriplegic, you know, the daily struggles, but also that he was a humorous character, a smart character, and more importantly, he's a character that women fall in love with. Mm. You know, the thing that happens here is, and in fact, the thing I really wanted to show is that the disability is the least important thing about somebody. You may see the chair initially. I guarantee you within 20 minutes, you will forget about the chair and you will just be focused on this character. Yeah. And that was what was really important.
And by the way, speaking of things that some people might see as a disability and others mm-hmm. might not, you have a child who's deaf and you've said that you are infuriated when other people have an attitude towards his deafness.
Yeah, I do. We took about 2 weeks to accommodate the fact that our son was profoundly deaf. You know, it was a shock because we had no deafness in the family. And then you get over yourself and you realize that it might not be the life you predicted, but it'll be an entirely wonderful life. It'll just go in a different direction. And I worked out pretty quickly that my son's biggest problem was going to be how other people viewed him rather than any ability or lack of ability that he had. And I still hold that to be the case. Yeah. He is as smart and funny and infuriating and lazy and tricky and, you know, silly as any 11-year-old boy now. And, you know, we don't think of him as a disability. We think of him as a person. So I guess that was feeding into my writing of the book and another reason why I feel passionately that this should not, you know, be seen as some kind of how-to manual.
Yeah. It's also a story about class. In one scene, mm-hmm. she's gone with him to a wedding that she would never have gone to and is sitting in his lap. They're dancing at the wedding, and he remarks on their closeness.
You know, you never would have let those breasts so near to me if I was in the wheelchair.
Yeah, well, you never would have been looking at these breasts if you hadn't been in a wheelchair.
Of course I would.
No, you wouldn't. You wouldn't. You would have been too busy looking at the leggy blondes, the ones you can smell an expense account at 40 paces. And anyway, I would have been over there serving the drinks.
One of the invisibles. Am I right?
Jojo Moyes, I want to ask you about a theme from the book, or at least a strand of the book that is not in the movie, which is the implication that Louisa, again, a small-town girl who stayed in the small town, had been assaulted, maybe at a party, maybe by a group of guys, maybe by more than one, which would explain, you know, her sort of staying in the town, not thinking as well of herself. Why not put that in the movie?
The problem is, and this was one of the kind of purest examples to me of the difficulties of translating book to film, was that in the book, there is an opaque reference, almost like a throwaway reference to the fact that Louisa may have been assaulted. The reader almost has to go back and go, did she just say what I think she said? And when we tried to translate that into the screenplay, and I worked with the director a long time writing this scene and trying different variations of it, it achieves a different weight when you do that in pictorial form. You cannot do it as a throwaway. The more we tried, the more we realized it just skewed the tone of the whole thing. And, you know, we still worry about that, but you have to make some decisions. You have to lose some things. And all I can say is it was done with a great deal of consideration.
Well, Jojo Moyes, one last thing that the book and film get at, which is so painful. It doesn't matter whether it's end-of-life decisions or somebody, you know, alcoholism or somebody deciding to do something risky you don't agree with. It doesn't matter what it is. You really, really can't change someone else.
That's exactly it. You know, people often ask me, what would you do in the same circumstances? And I come back to the same answer every time, which is going to sound a little wishy-washy, but I cannot know because I'm not standing in those shoes. And every decision that you make is going to impact on your family. It's going to impact on the people around you. And, you know, it's in the title. You know, the title means many things, but sometimes people say to me, does it mean I'm putting myself before you? And I suppose in that decision, you can see it that way.
Yeah, Me Before You is the name of the book and the movie. Jojo Moyes wrote both. It opens in theaters this week. Jojo, thank you.
Thank you so much.